On the subject of finishing well, you know, this has been on my heart a long time. I've spoken on this subject often at men's retreats and conferences. I've written about it extensively on my blog. I'm very personally concerned about it because when I was in Bible college in the late 80s, almost every chapel speaker talked to us about the problem of falling into some kind of sin that destroyed their ministry or somebody else's ministry. They would bring people in who hadn't spoken in a church in years, even simply for them to tell their story about how they fell. And as a freshman in Bible college, I kept thinking to myself, what is wrong with these people? Like, why are they all like, you know, falling apart, you know? And then as a sophomore, I was just, you know, tired of going to chapel and hearing the same thing all the time because we had chapel every morning at 7 a.m. And so the Bible college I went to started at 7 a.m. with chapel and ended at 5 o'clock in the afternoon every single day except Wednesday when you were teaching that night. Everybody in the school teaching that night. So anyhow, it was very intense. And I thought to myself, man, I'm just tired of hearing this every day, every day. And then as a junior, after I'd spent a summer working out with the prison system and things like that, I began to get worried. I began to think to myself, there's something to this. There's a problem that's developing here that we need to address. And then as a senior, I began to realize how widespread the problem was because there were three classes now ahead of me who had graduated, and several of them had already crashed and burned. And I began to do something in my heart. I was wondering, what have I signed up for? Over the next 18 years, I watched as almost everyone I graduated with in 1989 walk away from full-time paid ministry, and most of those walked away from Jesus entirely. So in 2008, I started reading about this. I started praying about it. I started teaching on it, and I just haven't stopped. Today, as we begin this series, I think it's one of the most prevailing weaknesses and problems in the Church of Jesus Christ today, our failure to finish well. Using grace is the excuse. We have allowed people to behave badly. We don't ever address things when we see them happening. And usually if we do, we do it in such a way that we don't help people, but we destroy them. Moreover, here's the thing I know. I am still young enough that I have many years to mess this thing up. One of the people that captured my attention in 2006 and 2007 was a pastor that I just thought the world of in El Paso, Texas. And I really liked him a whole lot. He'd built a really significant ministry that was just very effective in outreach and discipling people. They were really doing a great job. And he had moved away, and he moved back in 2006, 2007, came back to the same church that he'd left, and everybody was all excited that he had come back, and the church was on fire. They were totally motivated. I remember we went to one of their Christmas programs, and I remember thinking to myself, wow, this could be on Broadway, man. This is amazing, you know? And I heard him teach a message over about just a 20-minute little message at the end of that show that night. I wanted to get saved again. I'm just telling you, he was just amazing. He was gifted. I just thought, wow. The next year I came back and it was like everything had fallen apart. And I heard him give the message and I looked at my oldest son and I said, oh no, he's fallen into sin. I didn't say it to anybody else. I just said to my oldest son, because he was looking at me going, what's wrong, Dad? Something's really, really wrong. We moved to Dayton, Ohio a few months later, and I got a call, would you consider the position at such and such church? Our pastor had an affair at Christmas time, just before the show. And we don't know what to do. It's the third pastor to fall like this in succession in our church. Later that following year, in 2009, I got the call to go to my anniversary meeting, 20th anniversary of our Bible college graduation. And I don't belong to that denomination anymore, so I wasn't initially invited. But eventually they decided to invite me because I was one of only three people who were actually in ministry left. So they decided maybe it was worthwhile to invite me. I'm not the expert. I'm a man with clay feet. I'm coming to you as a fellow traveler on a rocky road of life with clay feet. I'm hoping that you will hear my heart and you will buy in and you will take this series as a matter of urgent need in the body of Christ today for the sake of our children, for our children's children, and for the witness of the Christian church in the United States of America. Because globally, the church is growing. Globally, the church is doing really well. But in Western Europe and in the Americas, where we've always thought of it being the headquarters of the church virtually in our generation, well, that's where we're not doing so well. And by far and away today, the majority of Christians in the world do not live in the United States, they don't live in Canada, and they don't live in Western Europe. There are more Episcopalians in Kenya than there are in all of the United States, Canada, and the United States, Canada, and Western Europe. There are more Roman Catholics dispersed around the world as Filipino people than there are Catholics in Europe. Folks, the church is changing, it's globalizing, it's going around the world, and the average Christian today is 16 years old and not white. If you take a look around this room, you will realize that we are not the average anymore. It's time for us to wake up in the United States of America and to be the church and to finish well. You see, one of the things that intrigued me through that, it was that, you know, whenever I was in Bible college, I was a brand new Christian. I really shouldn't have been there. Can I just be real honest? I really shouldn't have been there. I was such a baby Christian. And I heard and saw things that were really tough as a baby Christian. But here's the thing that got my attention in all of this. That I watched a lot of rising stars shoot up and flame out. It doesn't matter how you start. I don't care where you are today. What I want to know is, how are you going to finish? How are you going to finish? Well, our first finishing well hero is a woman named Hannah today. I named one of my daughters after her because I thought so much of Hannah. I have incredible respect for this woman. What I love about Hannah is that she not only finishes well, but in her day and age, she shows a tremendous amount of chutzpah, some veracity. She is an amazing woman of faith and is bold in speaking out, considering the context in which she lived in and everything else. And her pursuit of God and obeying him above all others just makes Hannah such an important person for you and I to take a look at. So I'll be reading from the English Standard Version today. Please read along in whatever translation you have. That's my favorite translation, the one that's in your lap. And let's take a look. 1 Samuel chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. And there was a certain man of Ramathian Zophim of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jehoram, son of Elihu, son of Tahu, son of Zuf, an Ephraite. Say those three times fast. You know, so, okay. And he had two wives. This could be the beginning of his problems. What are these guys thinking? I just wonder that sometimes. I just like, dude, just get it once, right once. Okay, so anyhow, the name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where there were two sons of Eli and Hophni and Phinehas, who were priests of the Lord. And on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah and his wife and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb, and her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her. And he's not helping, and he doesn't even know it. But that's okay. That's another message altogether. Because the Lord had closed her womb, so it went on year by year. And as often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and could not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons?" And after they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. And now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head." As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth, and Hannah was speaking in her heart, but only her lips were moving, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman and said to her, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." But Hannah answered him, "No, my Lord, I am a troubled woman in spirit. I've drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation." And then Eli answered, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant your petition that you've made to him." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." And the woman went away and ate, and her face was no longer sad. They rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah, and Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel, for she said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." Then Elkanah and his house all went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever." Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." And so the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a three-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, "O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence, praying to the Lord. And for this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." And he worshiped the Lord there. I love Hannah. Her life is not only of extreme value to the story of Samuel, the judge and prophet, but it's also of great value to us in many other ways. Consider Hannah's relationship with Peninnah, Elkanah's other wife. The verbal abuse that she endures there. And yet, here's the thing that captivates me. Hannah does not blame God, but rather seeks his help. She recognizes that God is not to blame for Peninnah's actions. I'm already impressed. Can I tell you that this is one of the things that just is the most baffling to me in the church? How God gets the blame for things that everybody else does. To the point that I see people walk out on God all the time because someone wasn't nice. I really don't understand it. I mean, I understand that what it hurts like, and I understand that we expect that Christian people would behave differently and that somebody would appreciate all the hard work we've done and things like that. But here's the thing is that I wonder when was the last time that you really wanted God to take away your free will and make you do what the other person wanted you to do. Hello? I mean, there are many times where I'm quite certain that what I did was right and somebody else didn't want me to do it. And I know they prayed. Sometimes not even so covertly. God, make him do that. Make him behave. I was thinking to myself, I am behaving. I did exactly what I thought the Lord told me to do. And here we couldn't both be right. But we were both certain the other one was wrong. And we wanted God to do something about it. Hello? We want grace for all the mistakes we make and law for when it's the other person. Law for the other person, right? Judgment for the other person. Grace for me. I'm a good person. I'm so nice. I'm just so sweet, I can almost lick myself. But those other people, God, you better deal with them. You ever done that? I'm sure not you. I'm sure it's somebody else that does stuff like that. But I can tell you that there are many times when I've thought to myself, God, I hope I'm on the right side of this thing. But can I tell you that blaming God will be one of the surest ways to stop us in our tracks from growth, from experiencing his presence, not because he withdraws, but as we become angry at him, we withdraw. And eventually we just kind of shut ourselves off from the Lord. He doesn't move from us. We just quit listening, quit praying, quit hoping. Hannah's a wise woman. In the midst of her distress, she presses in and she recognizes that Penaniah is a broken person and needs the Lord just as much as she does. So she doesn't curse her as her enemy. She doesn't pray, God, straighten that woman out. She says, Lord, hear my prayer. Grant me that child. Take away my affliction. Now, let me say this is really important here. When it says here that God closed her womb, it does not mean that he did something mean to her. For whatever reason, he at this point had not yet given her a child. That is the language of that. It does not mean that he was acting against her. Notice, she's not angry with God. She's seeking his power to change the situation. One of the tendencies on our part as 21st century Americans, as we read something like that, and we have this kind of hyper-offended culture. It's very neurotic. And so we pick up everybody else's offense. All you have to do is spend a few minutes on Twitter or Facebook to know that more people pick up other people's offenses. And that's why we like to post them, right? So that everybody will get on board with us and be just as offended at this other person or Walmart or whatever else. And so we create this culture of offense that just stirs things up, makes our whole society very neurotic. We call it self-righteousness. Self-right. It's funny because I always hear it applied to church people. And yet some of the most self-righteous people I know have never been to church and are looking to find fault with God. But look at Hannah. Hannah's the one, if anybody ought to be offended at God, is not mad at God. She seeks his help. She seeks a change in the situation. And when Hannah seeks God, he answers her. And he delivers for her just what she asked. A son who would serve the Lord forever. Now, from a literary standpoint, can I tell you that just from a writing standpoint, this is really neat the way this is beginning to develop, because what you're seeing is kind of a fractal. You're seeing the story being retold in miniature. And so Hannah's barrenness, her becoming pregnant after receiving a prophetic word, and the life of Samuel, her son, these all become kind of the retelling of Israel's current situation. Israel is spiritually barren. There's a spiritual barrenness in Israel, and Peninnah and her children are essentially like the nations around them taunting Israel. And it becomes a picture. The story is being retold again. It fits together very powerfully. When Samuel penned this all in years later, it's really interesting how God took those things and put them together to illustrate the story out of his own life, even over the way it was written, not just in the unfolding of the events. A lot of times when we come across something like this and we hear that the Lord hardened someone's heart or something like that, or we say that the Lord made someone had someone barren, the first thing we do is we just kind of have this attitude of, God's not very nice. But can I just tell you that the biblical picture is one that God does not waste our hurts but puts them to good use. That hurt and pain and suffering is all around us, that we live in a fallen world where sin and disease and sickness have entered in because of the sin of humanity. Not because anyone's picking on you. And so, in these moments where we see these kind of anthropomorphisms of God acting in history in that way, we start to take every little individual thing personal and get our feelings hurt and think that God is against us. But not Hannah. See, that's one of the reasons that Hannah finishes well. Is because she steps back in the context of human history. And she goes, hey, I need God's help. Instead of blaming God. So God brings forth a son, and she dedicates him to the Lord. This is what I really love. She does what she says she will do. You ever made a vow to God? Anybody here made a vow to God you didn't keep? Man, God, if you'll get me out of this one, I will go to church every Sunday. Or until it's inconvenient, or I got to go to the beach, or I've got to, God, if you get me out of this one, I won't just tithe. I'll give 90% of my income. I'm looking for that person. I'm just, I'm kidding. But it's the things we do. We make all kinds of rash vows to the Lord. Hers was not a rash vow. You see, it was going to cost her a lot. Can you imagine taking your young child and going to a city far away where you can only go once a year to see them? She took her child up there because she had made this promise. And she doesn't just make the promise in a kind of half-hearted way, or even just comply like someone who is angry fulfilling a vow. Because I've watched that happen all the time. You know, like I've grounded kids before. You ever watch them comply? And outward, they're complying, but inward, there's no compliance whatsoever. It does them no good. You know, they're bitter in their heart. So on the outside, they may be sitting, but on the inside, they're standing. Hello? You ever been that child? Just at 40-something? Okay. But she's not like that. She every year makes a new garment for her child when she comes to worship. When they go to worship, I mean, this is these people. I don't know what their status is financially, but I'm impressed. They bring a bull, the proper sacrifice for a priest that is coming into service. Even though he's only a child, she didn't say, well, he's only a child, so maybe we'll do this later or whatever. No, she fulfills the vow. She follows through on everything. They sacrifice a bull. She does everything that she's supposed to do, just like if he was an adult, because she's dedicating him to the Lord. She pours her heart into it. She comes year after year. They are faithful in every expression, even so much so her husband's going, well, you know, wow, like whatever you think the Lord is saying to you, like, I mean, she's for real. She's going to finish well. Can I just say that one of the things I would really urge you is not to make excuses for your rash vows, but to fulfill them. See, I filled a lot of vows over the years that have been really painful to fill. I've stayed places because I'd made a vow that I would stay when I didn't want to stay. And I had means to go. But I gave my word, and I fulfilled my vow. I've paid things to people only later on to find out that they lied to me to get that money out of me. But can I tell you that my vow before the Lord was my vow before the Lord. And just regardless of what they did to deceive me, I made the vow of my free will. And so I keep my vow. Isn't it great that God keeps his vow when you don't keep yours? I find that always an intriguing thing. We expect God to keep his promises, even when we're liars and fornicators and deceivers and mean-spirited and everything else, and we hold God to the nth degree. You keep your promise, God. And then the first time we find out that somebody else did the same thing to us, we go, oh, well, I should be able to get out of this because, well, they were deceptive. They were liar. They were, really? What if God could get out of his vow like that? Oh, but he's God. I mean, he's held to a different standard. Can I just tell you that when we're talking about finishing well, that there is no greater witness to your trust and confidence in God that when someone else is deceptive, mean-spirited, unkind, that you do what is right regardless. Wow. Now that's a witness. I know, you can go to court. You can get out of it. You can get out of those credit card bills. I mean, it wasn't you that signed the credit card, right? Or was it? It wasn't you that went out to dinner at Bonefish Grill and decided not to pay the bill now because you can't pay your Visa bill. Church, we have to behave differently than the world around us. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right or just. Finishing well means we keep our promises. We keep our promises on marriage covenants. We keep our promises on visa agreements. We keep our promises on house agreements. We keep our promises on handshakes. When we give our word, when people deceive us, we keep our promises. That's finishing well. There is no credit to us, legal or not. When we break our word, when we lie and deceive because someone else has lied and deceived to us, there is no victory in that, church. And if we behave just like the world, oh, but it was legal. And then the world says, hypocrite. I'm grateful for grace. I'm really grateful for grace. But church, there's something wrong that we don't finish well. And can I tell you, even that among those pastors that I've spoken to that I graduated from, that their number one reason that they fell out of ministry was because of churches not keeping their word to them. So the pastor doesn't keep his word, the church doesn't keep their word, and the world makes a right judgment against us. See, the scripture doesn't invite us to point our fingers at the world. It invites us to look and examine our own hearts and one another, and to outlive the world, not to condemn it. For God so loved the world that he gave his son. Not that he was so irritated with it, disappointed in it, tired of it, angry at it, but because he loved the world. And then he deputized us. He gave us the ministry of reconciliation, to be the good news of Jesus Christ to the very ends of the earth. Finishing well is desperately important for the church. Now, keep in mind, Hannah and her husband are Levites. So they're of a priestly lineage. They're supposed to be dedicated to God. Of course, not everyone who's supposed to be is. But they're Levites. They're called to be a tribe of priests. Just like every believer in Christ is called to be a priest of God. And they give them their lives away. He will truly be dedicated to you. And here's what I love. It's not just a dedication ceremony she does. It's not just that she's saying that he's going to grow up going to church. She doesn't mean that, it's just going to be an outward life of being obedient. She means, God, take away my distress, and I and my son will be yours to do with as you see fit. And then she backed it up. She gives him to Eli at a very young age. She gives the offering for the priest. She does all these things. She doesn't cut any corners. She brings a new ephod every year. She's a devoted mother all the days of her life. She withholds nothing. And God blesses her and her family tremendously. Now, I got to back up just one thing here. Eli's critique of her. He thinks she's drunk. He says some kind of angry, unkind words to her. Do you know how many people would have gotten mad and stormed out of church for something like that? But Hannah's reaction is she doesn't pick up that offense either. Instead, she assures Eli and even speaks to him with respect. No, Lord, I am not drunk, but troubled. Man, I have a big problem with the way Eli treated her. Can I just tell you that it's clear that Eli lacks compassion. And as we look at the life of Eli, we're going to see that his sons are a real problem. But I got to tell you, I love Hannah because her heart is after God, not the approval of man. And so all the things I can tell you about Hannah is not just simply that she finished well, not just simply that she didn't pick up inordinate offense or allow her feelings to control her life, but that she was someone whose heart was so after God that even when the approval of man did not bring joy to her heart, even when she was mistreated and spoken of evil, her heart was after God's heart. So when you look at her character, this is a woman who doesn't blame. You know how you spell blame, don't you? You spell it be lame. Hannah's life isn't easy. And yet she doesn't waste to trust God when everything's going her way. She doesn't wait to trust God after she gets what she wants or after the baby comes. She doesn't wait to trust God in whenever the verbal abuse stops or whatever else. No, she trusts God in the midst of trial, of verbal abuse. She trusts God in the midst of barrenness. She trusts God even when her character is being called into question and being called a drunkard. You know, one of the most important things that happened to me when I was in Bible college was one of my professors kicking several students out of the classroom for whining about church members. It seemed that weekend that one of the other students had their integrity questioned, their character questioned, and they were just incredulous about it and came into the classroom complaining about it, and before long about half the classroom was joining in talking about those church people that were just so this and so that. And my professor pointed out to them, just kind of gently, you know, both Jesus and the apostles had their character and integrity questioned. I just, you know, wonder if that's just, you know, part of the deal and being in ministry. And the student just continued to whine. And before long, all of a sudden, it was like there was this murmur in the classroom that was taking over the classroom. And I remember our professor, he just went Rand Paul on him, man. I mean, it's like he was going to set the story straight right now. And I remember sitting there stunned as he just said, get out of my classroom. I thought people were mature enough to be pastors. I thought that's why you were here. Get out of my classroom and don't come back until you decide to act like grown-ups. Jesus was the sinless Son of God, and every day people questioned his integrity. And yet they called him a liar and a devil. Yes, even religious people. So get over yourself because you're not better than Jesus. Can I say to us, church, when people say rough things to you and tough things to you, they said them to Jesus. They questioned his integrity. They questioned his intent. They questioned all the things that he was going to do. And church, when I took that message to heart, it's why I'm still preaching 26 years later. It's why I'm still following Jesus. And if you want to finish well, you are going to have to get over yourself. Get over yourself at church. Get over yourself at work. Get over yourself at school. Get over yourself at home. Get over yourself in the doctor's office. Get over yourself on the highway. Get over yourself in the driveway. Get over yourself on the ball field. Get over yourself in your marriage. Get over yourself in your family. Get over yourself at the store. Get over you. And you will be able to finish well. Hannah cried out to the Lord and waited for her rescue. It wasn't overnight. And until then, she lived perfectly. Not perfectly, but authentically. She didn't justify acting poorly like a spoiled brat like my fellow students did. And when she didn't get what she wanted, she waited until it was the Lord's time to do so. And in the fullness of time, God did. Church, we want to be world changers. Well, the place you start to change the world is in the mirror. So how do we start? It starts with all of us right here in this room. Individually, making the decision, I will finish well. And then making that decision again every day of our lives. Let's stand together. You know, for some of us, it just begins in a prayer. Begin a relationship with Jesus Christ and to say, Father, I need your help. I've lived the way of the world long enough. And my solutions haven't put me in a better place. I'm not living the way I want to. And so I just say to you today, I surrender. I'm asking you to take control of my life, to be the boss of my life, to lead me, to guide me, to give me strength, to give me wisdom, and to forgive me when I fail. I just invite you now to come into my life. Would you send your Holy Spirit to seal the deal in me so that I can begin this new life in Jesus? And if you prayed a prayer like that this morning, or you're thinking about praying a prayer like that, I just want to tell you, we've got some volunteers in the background, some prayer team people who would love to visit with you and talk with you about that decision. Maybe today you've been walking with the Lord a long time, but you've been kind of in this place of where you're saying to yourself, when do I grow up? When do I mature? When do things change? And so there's not a day that goes by that I don't hear from somebody who's been a Christian a long time, and they're wondering when that day comes. And can I just tell you that if you're waiting for it to come, the day doesn't come. The day comes when you press in and pursue God. He already pursued you. He pursued you to the point of shedding is the blood of his son on the cross. He's already pursued you. He's pursuing you to the ends of the earth through Christians who go out and share and tell the good news, who live the good news. Can I tell you that if we're not out there pursuing, then no one is. And so the call today for you and I is to be in hot pursuit of the world. Beginning today and then finishing well. So maybe you want to visit with our prayer team people back there. Maybe you want to turn to the person next to you. But let me tell you that your commission has already come. Your commission, the day that you accepted Jesus Christ, was to tell the next person who didn't know that Jesus was the hope and the way and the life and the truth that you know. You're one step ahead of somebody. Maybe you've been walking with Christ a long time. You've just watched his work in your life. You're ahead of somebody. Maybe you feel like a baby Christian after years and years. Can I tell you, you're ahead of somebody. Finish well. Finish well, church. The whole world needs for you to finish well. For you and I to go out and love God, to love people, and to pass it on. Let's worship the Lord together.